Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jingyi Lee from the University of Arizona. Joining us today are Noma Vanderveer from Leiden University and Dr. Catherine Lowe from University College Maastricht. Their new edited volume, Public Health in Asia During the COVID-19 Pandemic, Global Health Governance, Migrant Labor, and International Health Crisis, was published recently by Amsterdam University Press. It examines the impact of the past 2 years of pandemic on public health policies in several Asian countries as well as on their labor policies. So welcome, Anoma and Catherine. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Before we talk about the book, can you tell us about yourselves and your research? What do you work on?
Okay, I can start first. Hello, everyone. My name is Catherine Noh. I was born and raised in Hong Kong. I'm currently assistant professor at University College Maastricht at Maastricht University. I'm a political scientist by training, but I have conducted interdisciplinary research in international relations and global health with an Asian focus. In other words, my research looks into the interaction between states and international organizations in responding to global health problems, including antimicrobial resistant crises and infectious disease outbreaks such as SARS, H5N1, HIV/AIDS, and of course, COVID-19.
Thank you. That's very okay. I see where this book is coming now. But Anoma, what about you?
Yeah, I don't have a thorough introduction like that. My name is Anoma van der Veer. I am, as you can probably sense, tell from the way I pronounce my name, very Dutch, which also explains why I'm affiliated to the Leiden Asia Center at Leiden University. And I'm actually a researcher there, and I have been for quite a few years, although I'm based in Japan right now for a variety of reasons we won't have to go into. But I do research into public health, basically, and I've done projects on public health in different from different perspectives, for example, disability studies, but also digital health. This book is also a product of that particular field of research. That's basically it. That's my whole introduction.
Well, thank you. Welcome. So this is a very timely book, obviously. When we thought the pandemic was about to be over, it kind of started again. So how did this, I guess, I always ask how our authors begin to work on their volumes. But so obviously the pandemic was a big pushing force in the topics of books. But how did you and the contributors decide to focus on issues of global health policies and migration in Asia?
So let me take this one. This book actually started out as as a discussion between me and my boss and our manager at the Light and Asia Center about how we were extremely frustrated with how Asia was represented in European and American media. As you might know, there's I think everyone in fields that deal with Asia kind of have to deal with these misrepresentations, these oversimplifications, these cultural generalizations. Like everyone in Japan listens very well, and everyone in China also listens very well. You know, there's no individuality; they're all very homogenous. And what happened over the course of the first few months of the pandemic is that you had these countries that were doing a lot better than European countries. So what you saw in reaction in European media and among European politicians, but also problematically amongst policymakers, is that they pointed at Asia saying that, well, this is not how we can do it because they're different. These are different people. And by doing that, they kind of ignored the whole public policy perspective, right? They didn't actually look at how these governments formulated policies to deal with the pandemic. Rather than that, and this is, we actually talk about this in our introduction as well. Because you know I'm Dutch, I read a lot of Dutch policies, and we kind of came across this. And Catherine also works in the Netherlands, of course, so she probably knows this all too well as well. We came across this example of two policymakers at the Ministry of Health who were tasked with making an international comparison between different countries to explain how different governments tackled the pandemic to inform Dutch policies. Well, This was nothing more than just cultural overgeneralizations packed into a little report that made everything worse than it should have been, and it was basically just one long explanation of why the Dutch government did what it did. Instead of looking at actually looking at countries and saying, well, they did it like this, maybe we can take lessons here, we can learn something here, they basically said, well, they're doing this, but you know, because South Korea is very feminine and we are not, then we can't do that because, you know, the South Koreans are feminine. It's a very painful way of seeing Asia. And this is the frustration that we kind of dealt with over the course of writing the whole volume, but I think this was actually how the whole book started. And for this reason also, most of the authors in the book, they are either based in the country they're studying, or they are from the country they're studying, or they are living and working there, or they have a lot of experience with these countries, right? So we don't have any authors, and we did this on purpose, we don't have any authors who just basically write about a country that they've been on vacation with for 2 weeks. You know, we have actual authors based in their locations or have a lot of years of experience of working with the governments there. I think that makes the difference, especially when you read the book, because it's very accessible. It's very short chapters. But this was the whole rationale of the book.
Great. Catherine, would you like to add something?
As I said before our recording, I was the latecomer of the volume, but I really loved the idea proposed by Anoma and his manager, and that's why I jump in to as an editor of the book. And yeah, I think this is like something I want to like add.
That's fantastic. So what's the structure of this book and what specific problems does each part address?
Okay, I think I can take this question. So this volume of the consists of four main themes, which are health policy in Asia and the global community, the future of global health governance in Asia, domestic responses to COVID-19 in a globalized Asia, and lastly, migrant workers and the global economy during COVID-19. So part one of the book assesses health policies in Asia and the interactions between the agencies at national, regional, and global levels in terms of infectious disease outbreaks. Part two of the book looks into the function of the WHO in coordinating disease responses in Asia so as to envision the role of the institution in global health governance in the future. Part three of the book includes four chapters illustrating domestic responses to COVID-19 in Asia. These case studies explore the various factors that have contributed to or restricted an effective response to COVID-19 in these respective countries and the effects on the local population. The final session of the book takes a closer look at the effects of COVID-19 on workers in different Asian countries, in particular non-regular workers and migrant workers. The final session examines the socioeconomic impacts of COVID-19 related measures in societies in Asia. So this is the overall structure of the book and also the problems that we try to address in each session.
Thank you. That's very thorough. And it obviously covers a lot of very important topics under health and immigration. So in the beginning of the book, you mentioned this dual approach in the volume. So I guess before we talk about the actual problems, I also want you to have a chance to explain a bit of your method here. What is this dual approach thing?
Yeah, so it's actually quite simple. We were talking amongst the authors, amongst the contributors, and amongst the editors, of course, about what are the most salient topics right now when it comes to the pandemic. Because everyone talks about, you know, the small things. Are we, just to give an example, most people were talking about the masking problems or the vaccinations or the, you know, it's the very common themes that are very easily politicized that in the end affect, how things turn out. But what we wanted to talk about were the things that people actually don't really wanted to talk about. And I think those were global health governance for one. So how is it conducted in unison, or how are people cooperating, or how governments cooperating, or actually how they're not cooperating, which was most of the time the case, through this very large international, supranational institution, the World Health Organization. And the other one was migrant labor, which is very much attached to that, because especially in Asia, migrant labor has become very important. We have different levels of economic development, so we have a lot of different countries sending migrants or receiving migrants, and this very much affects how global health governance is perceived. Right? For example, if you're in Indonesia, you're sending out a lot of migrants, and then a pandemic hits, and then you get a lot of migrants back. Well, how do you deal with that? You turn to the WHO because, you know, this is this international organization that can maybe help you deal with this thing, or the International Labor Organization, and help you with setting up rules. And then you find out that they're not actually prepared to deal with this kind of stuff. So when we talked about what do we want to tackle with this book, these were the big the two big themes that we wanted to talk about. That's why I'm also so happy that Catherine came on board, because she knows so much about the WHO. It's just it's a little ridiculous, it's amazing. So I'm very happy she came on board, even though she said she's a latecomer. She was extremely helpful in getting this all together. So these were the two big themes that we wanted to tackle, and that we kind of did with this book. So I'm quite happy with the results.
That's great. And we'll get to the WHO part later. So since this pandemic mostly started in Asia at first, then spread to other parts of the world, as you said in the beginning and in the book, Asia played a very important role in the discussions of health policies and entry bans or future preventions of other sorts of pandemics and so on. So in these case studies, what have you found about the representations of Asian countries, and what are some of the underlying problems in these representations?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question. I think I can start first, and Anoma can jump in later on. You correctly point out that Asia is a very interesting region to study for most global health scholars and researchers. If you consider the major infectious disease outbreaks in the 21st century, including SARS, H5N1, H7N9, and COVID, and these infectious diseases are originate and first reported in Asia, more precisely China. Since viruses do not respect borders, during an infectious disease outbreak, it is crucial to let neighboring countries to access to key information about the disease, so that countries could respond to the outbreak or potential outbreak individually and collectively in a timely manner. However, information transparency and the presence of an independent media are quite lacking in non-democratic countries like China. So countries in Asia still hold a memory during the SARS outbreak, in which some local Chinese officials attempted to cover up the initial outbreaks of SARS in 2002, causing the spread of the disease in six countries in the world within 24 hours. Therefore, during the initial outbreak of COVID-19, many countries in Asia immediately closed their border with China, despite the WHO advice against the measure. I would say there is a lack of trust and communication between countries in Asia.
Noma, would you like to add something?
Yeah, so if I can talk about that last part of your question. So what have I found about the representations of Asian countries? I think that was your question, right? And what the impact was on global health governance of that. But that's not necessarily one of the big topics of the book, because we really wanted to talk about the countries themselves. But we do talk about it in the sense that we talk about what the effects are for the global community. Right. So we have one of our first chapters is about how do we deal with this idea that the WHO, for example, its reputation has kind of been eroded. It's declined. And one of the reasons for that, of course, was China's role in the WHO, which Catherine can talk a lot can talk about more a lot more, but we have a chapter, for example, that examines the actual case. You know, how effective or how cooperative has China been, or what level of influence does China have in the WHO, which also, you know, is limited to an extent, although they try, like every other country does, because Japan tries just as hard, but yeah, they're not as successful. I think because what Catherine said, all these diseases, all these infectious diseases originate from Asia, that this is also the representation of Asia. That it's kind of a paradox, right? We have this idea that at one point there They're this incompetent batch of people, which consists of 1/3 of the world, that continuously bring out all these infectious diseases that affect the rest of the world. And on the other hand, then we have all these cases that they look, you know, especially in Europe, you look at Asia and then, oh, but they're doing it quite well handling this, right? So it's a paradox between this incompetent batch of people and this very competent batch of people. And I think this has very much affected how we conduct global health governance, because especially in the WHO, we see that it's cherry picking, right? You cherry pick the representations you kind of need to argue your current position. And because the WHO does this, you see the same thing happening in national governments. And I also think this is why Europe was very late in responding to the pandemic, because they looked at Asia through the lens of they're very incompetent, they're not handling their things very well. And then it came over to them, and then it all happened to them. And then they're like, oh, well, we're going to have to use a different lens and maybe see if we can, you know, have our own approach. And then that didn't work. And then they changed lenses again. And then they said, well, but because, you know, Asians are just very different, so we can't do it like they do. It's very frustrating. It's very, personally, I find it makes me quite irritated. As an academic, it makes me frustrated because it ignores it. Basically, what happens is everyone except Asians ignore Asia. That's what it all comes down to. That's what it all boils down to. That affects global health governance because, you know, Europe and the U.S. are overly powerful in these big institutions like the WHO. They're overly powerful in decision making internationally when it comes to global health governance. And yeah, China and Japan, they have some weight, but they don't have enough weight to dispel this negative or positive, or overly positive or overly negative representations. And I think that is very problematic. I'll just leave it at that. I could rant about this for another hour.
Yeah, yeah. It's painfully accurate. But let's talk about the WHO for a bit, because quite several of the chapters cover this topic. So what is, or what was, I guess, the role of WHO in this whole pandemic? What did they do? And what was the significance of the WHO for different countries? And I guess if it had any impact on global health governance and health policies in these Asian countries, what kind of problems do you see in its impact?
Mm-hmm. I can take that question. As Anoma mentioned, I know a lot about WHO in both good and bad way. Regarding to global health governance, then we need a governor, and the only governor in global health governance is World Health Organization, WHO, which is very interesting and also very important for WHO to do a good job in managing global health affairs. And because of that, WHO always receives all praises and, of course, criticisms in dealing with global health problems, because they are the only one who manage global health crisis in the international level. And one of the main criticisms of the WHO is the Declaration of Public Health Emergency of International Concern, in short, we call it FIC. The WHO had the responsibility to determine whether an outbreak is a global public health emergency since 2005, under the international health regulations. WHO has only done these 5 times before COVID-19 and, of course, monkeypox. But the amount of time it has taken for the WHO to declare a particular situation as a fake has nevertheless became a focal point of criticism. For example, during the 2009 H1N1 outbreak, it took the WHO 38 days to declare a fake for H1N1. But it took WHO 138 days, 100 days more, to declare Ebola as a fake. So people are suspecting why it takes only 38 days for H1N1, but 138 days for Ebola. It is because H1N1 affects US more, and that's why, as Anoma mentioned, US had a bigger role and bigger influence in WHO, then they can push WHO to do something as soon as possible. And because Ebola is only so-called only happening in West Africa, then that's make the US and other advanced country not really concerned about Ebola more than H1N1. And this is the point of criticism of why WHO declares or does not declare a particular situation as a fake. And critics have argued that WHO decision is based on economic conditions of the affected countries. And some studies indicate that the direct impact of infectious disease on the US is a necessity condition for a global health emergency announcement. And in the case of COVID-19 outbreak, at the start of 2020, the WHO was blamed for serving the interest of the Chinese government, as Anoma also mentioned a bit before. And social media also widely report the case that WHO has been highly or widely influenced by the Chinese official. And then they claim or they say WHO should change name from WHO to CHO, Chinese Health Organization. So you can see how the social media also play a role in portraying WHO in a very negative way. And especially during COVID, during a pandemic outbreak, people are also afraid of the outbreak. And this uncertainty also led WHO losing its legitimacy in global health governance. So in general, I would say in the process, the legitimacy and trust of the WHO has gradually been eroded. And states, countries tends to ignore WHO advices. For example, when WHO declared COVID-19 as a fake, the WHO also advised states to keep borders open on the basis of the international health regulations. However, almost every country ignored WHO advice, and many countries even closed their borders to all nations, leading to an unprecedented crisis for migrant workers in a number of Asian countries that we will talk about it in later on, and also in the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, indeed. I personally am very familiar with that pain of the closed borders. But that's a story for another time. Now, since the beginning of the pandemic, some of the countries in Asia have been used in Western media as positive or negative examples for handling the situation. So among the positive examples, countries like South Korea and Japan were kind of praised by Western media as being completely competent in handling the situation super well and containing the pandemic very well. But many of the effective policies from Southeast Asian countries were overlooked. Now, part four of your volume analyzes domestic responses from several Southeast Asian countries. What are the conclusions and implications from this part of the volume?
Yeah, let me make a start on that, and hopefully Catherine can jump in wherever she wants to. It's a good question, because I feel like, and this is something that you can probably quote me on, but probably shouldn't. I feel like most of the world ignores Southeast Asia when it comes to basically anything. It's just not important enough for some reason, which is of course ridiculous. Because like you said, we have some examples of countries that are, you know, according to the logic of European policymakers, wouldn't be able to handle a pandemic like this. And they did, to an extent, although, of course, you know, it goes up and down. And I kind of dislike the idea that a country can do well or can do bad over a pandemic, because, you know, it stretches over a long period of time, and saying it does this or that is just too black and white. Sometimes they do well, sometimes they don't. And I think that is also one of the best things that you can learn from Southeast Asian countries, is that there is this this flexibility and mobility in how policy should be constructed. It should be made according to the situation you're in. This is what a lot of these Southeast Asian governments did quite well. They adjusted to the situation. Although I do have to mention here that the way they adjusted, and I think this is also this what probably touches upon why Southeast Asia has been ignored so much, is because the way they adjusted to the situation is not in line with how other countries might adjust to a situation. Like in Vietnam, for example, we see that the moment COVID-19 hit, their distrust for the Chinese government also hit, right? There's this embedded distrust of China in Vietnamese, amongst Vietnamese policymakers and amongst the ruling party. And what happened was, the moment that this became a thing, they reacted quite fast, rather quickly, also because they share a border with China, and there's a lot of, you know, inter-country, there's a lot of traffic between the two countries. But they reacted quite quickly. They closed the borders for one. Which of course the WHO didn't recommend, but you know, it still happened. And they reacted quickly to infections, and they started a full war against COVID-19. And I use the word war explicitly, because that is how they portrayed it in their PR, in their propaganda, basically. So there's a chapter in the book that talks about this, how you know, all the resources that they had and they learned over the course of the post-Vietnam era, you know, the anti-America rhetoric and propaganda, was fully utilized in the rhetoric against COVID-19, which of course, you know, also has its negative effects. And I think this is why it's not replicable in other countries, is because, you know, we had, for example, one case in which a woman came back home and she had COVID-19, she was infected, and she was basically just publicly lambasted. You know, it's a surprise she wasn't killed, to the extent of that. So, you know, and on the other hand, you have an English, I think he was a pilot, who got COVID-19, ended up in the hospital. The Vietnamese doctor saved him, and he became an example of how Vietnam is doing it better than the rest of the world, especially the Americans and the Europeans. So, you know, you can't really imitate that kind of approach. But what is also interesting was, for example, in Malaysia, where the COVID-19 pandemic hit, right at a moment of political instability. So what happened was, of course, policymakers and you know, the political leaders, they weren't ready for attacking this entire problem because, you know, they were dealing with stabilizing their own country. Surprisingly, you know, they at one point did manage to kind of steer it into the right direction, despite this political instability, because you had this entirely new challenge, the pandemic. So focus shifted to the pandemic, and stability became kind of like, well, we kind of have to be stable because we have to do this. We have to deal with this. This flexibility in response is something I think we can also learn a lot from, especially in countries that might be a little more, how do you say this nicely, inflexible, rigid in how they think about how things should be handled. Is that? I think that would be a conclusion and an implication of how we can learn things from the domestic responses in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, absolutely. I was quite amazed by when I was reading the book. I was just I didn't know most of what you mentioned in the chapter is because. Media representation can certainly change how we view other countries' policies and the amount that was not reported by Western media or vice versa can completely change how we understand the ways that other countries deal with this pandemic. But moving on to the next parts of your book, economy and labor are the focus, a very important focus of the book. And the lack of mobility during the past 2 years has greatly impacted the global economy. And I guess not just economy in a lot of sense. I would love to say education as one of the persons influenced by this. But in terms of labor migration, what do the chapters in this part discuss? And what difficulties are presented in this migration policies? What results have these policies about migration due to the country's economy, or what results do you think they might lead to in the future?
You want to take this one, Catherine, or should I?
I can take this one.
I feel like I've been talking too much and my mouth is dry now. No, it's... let me recap real quick. So for just my personal understanding, you just talked about the economy and labor, how this has affected labor migration, what difficulties are presented in migration policies. I think the biggest lesson that we've learned from this entire book and from this project, but not just that, just from the entire situation in Asia, is that when something like this happens, the first people that are affected are those in precarious labor situations. And those are migrant laborers most of the time. And migrant laborers, they come from countries that are not especially wealthy, don't have a very strong infrastructure to support the health needs of these laborers, especially when they suddenly come back in waves like they did in Indonesia, because Indonesia is a sending country, as one of our chapters talks about. They send out hundreds and thousands of laborers, if not millions of laborers every year. And all of a sudden they come back, they don't have a job anymore, but they do need health support. And then you have a country like Indonesia looking at the International Labor Organization and the World Health Organization for help. And they find out that neither of these have any policies in place that are country specific. They're all very general. So they don't account for any of the local factors, domestic factors that affect you know, the actual daily lived realities of the, these laborers. So I think that's one problem, and that's one of the I think that is just the biggest lesson we can take from this entire pandemic when it comes to migrant laborers, is that the ones that are most affected are usually the ones that shouldn't be affected the most because they're in the most precarious situation. And another chapter talks about Taiwan. It's exactly the same thing. It's because the health infrastructure in Taiwan is not aimed at supporting migrant laborers. They didn't receive the same level of support as Taiwanese citizens did, right? So what happened was that a lot of these laborers, they fled or they left their jobs, or, you know, they were fired because, you know, during the pandemic, a lot of people were just fired because of they cost too much. And then they fled because, you know, they didn't want to be repatriated because back home it might be even worse. So you have an entire community of people all of a sudden that are not covered by health insurance, who don't have access to basic health needs, who cannot get tested because, you know, once they go to a testing facility, they're rounded up and sent home. So they're not, and even if they're not, they're scared that it might happen. So you have these problems all of a sudden. How do you deal with a community like this that is scared of you as a government, while you still have to deal with them as a government, right? And in Taiwan, we see these smaller projects popping up, like the COVID-19 taxi, the Corona taxi, in which laborers can anonymously, you know, go to a testing facility, get themselves tested. At one point, you know, they start improving the health infrastructure a bit to make it easier for people who are illegally in the country to still receive, you know, certain healthcare, but you know, these are ad hoc solutions. They're not structural solutions most of the time, and I think that is when we talk about migrant labor in Asia. I think that is the biggest issue, is that none of these countries that we looked at were able to deal with migrant laborers because most of the time they're just viewed as second class citizens, and in the countries they're in, and for the countries that are sending them. You know, getting them back in waves and it's just in masses, it's just an enormous economic burden that they don't know how to deal with. And I think if we, you know, we talk about global health governance throughout this book, but I think one of the biggest challenges that we have when it comes to global health governance, especially in this day and age in which laborers go all over the world, mobility has increased tremendously, is looking at how can we ensure and assure that this doesn't happen again when it comes to these laborers, right? Because there's going to be another pandemic. We can be very sure that we already have monkeypox, right? And now that the world's media has already, you know, experienced this COVID-19 thing, every new virus is going to get the same level of attention or maybe a little less, but, you know, for at least the next few years, we are going to have more of these scares, and governments are going to have to respond to these scares. And the way they've responded over the course of the pandemic has not always been the most ideal way, because it has victimized the most vulnerable peoples. And that is, I think, one of the things we also want to say with this book.
Catherine, any additional comments?
Yeah, I'm thinking about when I heard what Anoma was saying. I was thinking about countries in China. I heard of like news saying that in the southern part of China there is a big African community, because these Africans, they stay in China for small businesses, and during the COVID, like the initial outbreak of COVID, many of these African residents, they were simply kicked out by Chinese landlord, and then they need to sleep underneath footbridges and on the passenger path, just because those Chinese thought these people are prone to having COVID. So you can also see the like the double stigma attached to these migrant workers that make them even more vulnerable. Although, like for China, they always praise they have really good relations with African people. But then when emergency comes, when pandemic comes, then they suddenly differentiate we, us, and then they just push these people out of the streets. And the local government had nothing they can do about it because these are the decisions made by these private landlords.
I'm really glad your volume is covering this issue, though, because so as a Japanologist, of course, I most of the information I paid attention to from the beginning of the pandemic was about the labor situation in Japan. And I noticed that in most of the media, in the reports, within the newspapers, most of them were about how after these migrant labor left Japan, or after they couldn't keep producing in the industry, Japan was now losing or had to stop or had to pause their factory lines for products like cameras and cars. And in America, actually, a lot of people were complaining about the shortage of car parts or computer parts from Apple factory, but nobody really paid much attention to the people who had to quit their job or were forced to quit their job or to leave the country. And as your book pointed out, they had nowhere to go. They had no place to stay. They had no health coverage in the middle of a pandemic. So yeah, I thought it was really great that your chapter is covering this.
Yeah, so we actually also have a chapter that talks a little bit more about, for example, the domestic situation in Japan. I think you make a very good point, especially when it comes to migrant laborers. They're the most vulnerable. But I think one of the things that has also been overlooked overall over the course of the pandemic is just vulnerable workers in general. And what we see, for example, in Japan Saori talks about this in her chapter on the form of capitalism and neoliberalization in Japanese policymaking in this book as well. She looks at how in Japan there's more and more precarious labor, right? There's more part-timers, there's more people that work in short-term jobs, day laborers, and these are people that are often not covered by health insurance. And these are, in Japan, for example, most often women. You know, of the 970,000 people that were dismissed in the first month of the pandemic in Japan, I think over 700,000 or something were women. The majority were women. And so what we talk about, and I think this is also what we wanted to talk about in this book, is that I think Asia is kind of the migrant laborer of the world when it comes to international public policy making and global health policy, is because it's so overlooked, and especially Southeast Asian countries, they're just treated as this rhetorical object, right? They're non-existent until they're relevant to the discussion, and I think that's very problematic. And over the course of the pandemic, I think we see this. A lot is that these are the people that are forgotten the easiest, because, you know, we talk about our cameras, we don't talk about the people who make our cameras. We talk about our cars, we don't talk about the people who make our cars. It's very easy to gloss over this because you're not affected by it, because the ones that are not affected by it basically are, you know, the rich people. So it's, but, you know, that's a whole different story we can focus on another time, maybe for our next book. Right, Catherine?
Yes, of course.
Indeed. Now, for some countries, the pandemic might seem to be over, but in many others, it's still very much present. So cases are rising in Japan, and China is seeing new rounds of citywide quarantines. Through the case studies of this volume, how do you think the public health policies should improve in the future? I know you've proposed a lot of potential lessons to be learned, but if you were to, if you were allowed to choose one, which ones would be the most important for you?
Okay, thank you for a question. I can start first. I think you're hinting at, I mean, your question hinting at the different approach. There are two main approaches using by countries around the world. One is living with COVID, and the other one is zero COVID strategy. And based on our understanding, most countries except China, maybe a bit of Taiwan, they are still sticking to a zero COVID strategy while the rest of the world is living with COVID. And for the Chinese zero COVID strategy, I would say the Western observer has viewed that zero COVID strategy employed by China as a very draconian but effective measure to maintain the low infection rate, considering the massive size of the country. That zero COVID strategy, why China insists on it? Because that strategy, apparent success has been a source of pride for the Chinese people. And the country's leadership has claimed the Chinese mobilization response to COVID demonstrate the government's superior governance capability. Like they can do better than the Western model, which is living with COVID. So this is the source of the legitimacy for the Chinese, for the CCP. And that's why the CCP, of course, they want to stick with it. And unfortunately, our book could not cover the Shanghai cases because our book finished before the arrival of the Omicron variant. So as the world know, Shanghai has the 3 months lockdown, which is very unimaginable because as a metropolitan financial hub of China, how come Chinese government can do such thing? But they did it extensively. And actually the causes of a lockdown is very expensive. Sources indicate that the Shanghai lockdown reduced national real GDP by 4%. And in fact, during the Shanghai lockdown, not only in Shanghai, but simultaneously, over 343 million people outside Shanghai, they were also undergone some form of lockdown. But of course, the media only focus on the case in Shanghai, but ignore the, actually, there are so many cities in China, they are also having these kind of semi-lockdown or total lockdown, whatever they name it. So although this zero COVID strategy could be a successful strategy for whatever variant we might encounter in the future, but China, of course, its economy will suffer from the effects of a long COVID. For example, the recent data shows that China only had a 0.4% GDP growth in the second quarter of 2022. So I think one lesson we should learn is how to balance the economic impact and also the social impact and the health impact of a country when we implement such drastic, maybe draconian measures. And the second lesson I'm thinking of is, like we talk about, the viruses keep evolving from from the original one to we have Beta, Delta, and then Omicron. So the virus keep evolving. I think so as our policy should change. We can't stick with the same policy and use the same policy for a different variant. If the virus can be that smart, I think we should be smarter than the virus.
I completely agree. Anoma, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. You got it. It's that you can't see my face, maybe though. But it's I could not agree more with that. Yeah, we need to be more flexible. I think that is Catherine said it better than I ever could. That is an excellent lesson to take from all of this. And I think as an extension from that particular thought, I think that we need to reframe and restructure and revolutionize how we look at global health governance. And we need to really, really rethink how we govern the WHO. I think that is an important part of this. So how we look at the World Health Organization, because for now, it's just, you know, they have these countries' offices, they have specific country plans, but for some reason, it's just still not flexible enough to actually balance this international need to the domestic needs. And there's just too little of both, and it just doesn't work. So when it comes to this flexibility of policy that Catherine mentions, I think this is also applicable for the WHO, not just for national governments. I think it should be much more wide than local governments, national governments. Should be everyone. Everyone should be thinking about this. And maybe not even governments, also companies, you know, how they deal with this and other stakeholders and NGOs and socially relevant, organizations. So yes, I could not agree more with Catherine when it comes to flexibility in policymaking. Yes.
Well said. Well, thank you for your time today. It was really great hearing your thoughts and analyses of the situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having
us. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
And for our listeners who want to find out more about how post-COVID public policies in Asia are impacting global economy and labor, make sure to check out this new book, Public Health in Asia During the COVID-19 Pandemic, Global Health Governance, Migrant Labor, and International Health Crises by Anoma Vandevia and Dr. Catherine Low. This is an open access book, which means anyone can access it for free, I think, online. This is Jing Yi from New Books in Japanese Studies. Stay tuned for our next episode.